Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. I am your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Our guest today is Wes Bush, and we speak with him about his new book on product-led growth, The Product-Led Playbook, how to unlock self-serve revenue and dominate your market with a tiny team.
And I think it really comes down to there's a lack of discipline in how you build your business. And that lack of discipline is causing you to be unfocused. And the whole point of a strategy is to have a disciplined line of sight of like, hey, this is the decision-making framework. And we're going to make decisions based on this strategy. And in order to follow through, we're going to focus on just these things. And it's actually harder to say no to some of these things than it is to just say yes to everything.
Wes started his journey working at VC-backed hypergrowth startups in demand generation, where he thrived by generating a high volume of leads for their sales teams. However, everything changed in 2016 during his tenure at Vidyard, when Wes launched a free product. Instead of paying hundreds of dollars to capture someone's lead info, he could simply give users a great free product and users would do the marketing themselves by sharing it with others. Millions of people have since used Vidyard's free product. Over the next 3 years, Wes wanted to see if he could replicate these results and started consulting hypergrowth and Fortune 500 software companies on how to grow faster by leveraging free products. His guidance was instrumental in helping these organizations accelerate their growth trajectories using a product-led growth strategy. In 2019, Wes released the best-selling book, Product-Led Growth: How to Build a Product That Sells Itself. This book popularized this new approach to doing business and sold more than 100,000 copies internationally from word of mouth alone. The monumental success of the book led to the rebranding of his consultancy in 2020, which emerged as productled.com, now recognized as the leading education company dedicated to advancing product-led growth. The relentless focus on empowering software companies to become product-led has yielded remarkable results. By 2023, 700 plus companies have collectively sold more than $1 billion in product-led revenue. Wes's mission is to make it easy for anyone to build a successful product-led business and change the way an industry sells for the better. He fulfills this by publishing free books and advising entrepreneurs on how to break through their product-led bottlenecks. When not helping his clients win, Wes enjoys traveling to exotic locations, playing pickleball, and reading a good history book. Now, onto this action-packed episode with Wes Bush. Wes, welcome back to Bits About Books. Delighted to have you back. What is it, 5 years now?
I know, it's been a while. So I'm excited to be back here and chatting with you about the new book.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm excited too. And you know, you are one of those rare journeys that I have been watching, right? And successfully, how you sort of caught up. PLG was not a big deal 5 years back, let's be fair. I mean, it was a new concept. People were, I mean, I know Kyle was writing about it and OpenView was sort of focused on that. And he was possibly the only guy besides you who was talking about that at that time on a consistent basis, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, so it has been wonderful how you built your space and how you sort of retained the focus on PLG. It has been fascinating. So tell me, what made you write another book?
Well, it's definitely not because it's like incredibly fun to write a book like this book. We had 16 rewrites. So it was a little painful writing it every once in a while. You're like, oh man. But like, what kind of kept driving me is I'm trying to figure out, we had hundreds of clients and I was trying to figure out like what separates, you know, the companies that really see success with PLG versus the ones that didn't. And so I was just going through the data, going through all our customers, trying to just piece together like what is the difference? Is it that they do onboarding better? No, that turned out not to be the case. Is it because they did like had a better offer? They had a better strategy? What kind of separated the winners from the people that just saw like mediocre success or no success whatsoever with PLG? And so that was really the kind of first starting off question for this book. I wanted to unpack that. I wanted to get a more predictable playbook where I'm like, okay, how could we really change the odds of these SaaS companies that implement PLG? And so that's what kind of sparked it for me. And I was just kind of creative in like figuring out like what are some of those big patterns. And my skill set, I would say, is just trying to find the patterns. And I write books to just distill that. And so I need a method to my madness. And the books just happen to be the best way to boil that down and simplify it.
Fantastic. So I will just sort of take you back to the early days when you wrote the first book and you came up with your bowling alley framework and the analogies and so on and so forth. What kind of learnings did you have in those early days? Because you had a sort of a structure in your mind, and you had your early clients who were coming in and you were implementing this for them. Did you find any sort of disconnect, or was it that what you had sort of outlined was pretty much playing out?
Yeah. So for that first book, what I found out kind of in hindsight is what it was really, really good at, the main job to be done that book is doing, is helping people decide, is PLG right or not for you? And so that was really what it was good at. There were some tactical things like the bowling alley framework that could help people implement pieces of it, but it was by no means like a, here's the comprehensive guide on how to build a product-led business. That piece wasn't quite identified yet. And so as we were helping some of the companies, we found out we had to kind of jump. I call this like three sales we had to make in order to get a customer. The like first one is, are you bought into PLG or not? Like that book hopefully does that, the very first one. The problem though is, what's the best approach to get there? Like we're aligned on point B, which is you want to build a product-led business, but from point A where you are today to that point, what is the best way? And whenever we started helping these companies, we found out like change management, getting everybody aligned on the best path to do this was really one of the hardest kind of obstacles. It wasn't that like PLG is just like prohibitively hard to do. It's just that there's an order to it. There's clear steps. And so we needed to align everybody on that path. What is the best approach? And so that's the second book, the product-led playbook, that really breaks it down so that everybody on the leadership team, everybody on the team can now know, hey, it's like these nine steps we got to go through. There's actually an order to this, and let's just execute the playbook. And this will be, our odds of success are going to be much higher than if we just tried to wing it. So that's kind of the lay of the land as far as the reason why.
Right. I'll come back to your process and analysis bit in a bit. But I have a question at this point. Is there something called product PLG fit?
Yes, I would say so. Like there's products where it's more naturally inclined to work. And then there's others where it's like, yeah, I wouldn't do that. I'll give you an example. So I was talking with the folks at VMware, and there's this one kind of reluctant salesperson who was like, you know, with his arms crossed, I don't think PLG can work for my product. Here's why. It's basically like, imagine the heart for the body. Like it's like that. It's core infrastructure. If this thing goes down, the entire business is screwed. So should that have a free trial? Should that have like this generous free motion, all those things? And like, no, like there's some products where it's more inclined to like enterprise sales motion. In that case, what the salesperson is actually doing is they're taking like this enterprise product and this one, creating something custom and blending it all together into one comprehensive solution. And I was like, you're providing so much incredible value there. Don't change that. Like, that's amazing. Now, if we're talking about how to create jot down your notes, or how to create a presentation, or how to like edit your audio podcast or something like that, those are some use cases that are actually quite simple to solve and are more inclined to a product-led approach where somebody's not going to want to pay, you know, multi-thousands of dollars per month to do it. They want a cheap, effective, accessible solution that they can just use, plug and play.
Yeah. I think because, especially SaaS, because we are really talking SaaS, everybody wants
to go to market and sell their stuff, right? So that's a universal need. And PLG looks super attractive because, okay, if I implement PLG, it'll just happen, yep. Right? So that's the expectation. Like anything else for that matter, all of us are in search of the silver bullet. I do one thing, and this goes to like a million users, right? I mean, we're all looking for that.
That's how it all works, right?
That's what we want. I mean, somebody has to do that. Anyway, yeah. So I think I get your point. Going back to this current book, so at what point in the last 5 years did you feel that, okay, this point A to point B journey is something, that process, now it's getting clearer that it is 9 steps, and these 9 steps are literally repeating themselves in the multiple of companies and customers you're working with, and potentially it would have emerged as 5 steps, and then that you would have sort of broken it further down, and this 9 steps would have emerged organically, I would like to believe. Where did you think that, you know, now I understand that there is this structure, before even you thought of putting it in a book?
Yeah, no, definitely. So I guess I was already starting to write the book or something. Like, and for me, it's just like I had that question that I started off with, like, what separates the good from great? And then it was like, okay, like, what is this? Is it an operating system? Is it something else as I'm kind of digging into it? And so what really kicked it off for me is there was like 324 plus customers we had at that time when I started this. And I just looked through all the customers, which ones were most successful, which ones weren't. What we identified is like 80% of our customers was actually at that time our ideal customers, which was like senior product executives that were going through our programs and we were serving them. And then I looked at the other 20%. I was like, huh, these are like a lot of SaaS founders. And then I went through like everybody's websites, I contacted them, I went through their self-serve motions, found the revenue, all that stuff. And it was fascinating. Actually, those 20% of founders generated 80% of the results of all those customers. And so I was like, wow, that's interesting. And so then I started reaching out, talking to all these founders. I'm like, what are you doing different? Because you're clearly like, at that time, we had focused on 4 things, which was onboarding, pricing, and like really going through understanding your ideal user and a bit on like your model. So like, what do you give away for free? So we just focused on those 4 things. And so I was like, what else are you doing? And what ended up coming out of some of those conversations was, hey, we're like implementing this as a company-wide thing. This is our core part of our strategy. It's not just a like call to action for us. And then for other things, it's like, okay, we had a growth process. We really understood our product data. And so I started to piece together, there was some other things going on behind the scenes. And I also started studying operating systems, like business operating systems, like the entrepreneurial operating system by EOS, Scaling Up. And I started looking at those tools and seeing, you know, what are the similarities like between the companies that are really aligned, structured, and product-led companies that are doing really well? And so I was like, oh, there is some overlap here with the operating systems. And so we got to have some operating system stuff and then also this PLG go-to-market stuff. And I got to blend them together. And that's what kind of came out of it, was the product-led system.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I think that's a great segue to actually get into the book. So at this point, would you like to tell me how you structured the book? You have 3 distinct sections, how you lead the whole thing, and which basically covers your 9 steps. I mean, that's the broad yep. framework, if I may say so. How did you decide to do this in this manner? I mean, what was the process?
I mean, I wish I could say I'm like, oh yeah, it's all me. This structure was brilliant. I had one piece, and I think for any author, this is like an amazing reference that anybody should check out. So his name's Simon Bowen, and mm-hmm. he created what's called like the genius model. So it's like, it's a Venn diagram, a fancy Venn diagram. And what I loved about the genius model is it just naturally breaks everything down into 3 phases, and each phase has 3 components. And in between each of those phases, there's like certain core outcomes. that both of them do. And so you have like these two phases, they each kind of roll up into one core outcome. And so I started with that, trying to play around with, okay, what might be those three things for each of those phases? And I found it hugely kind of clarifying for just how to break down each of those specific phases, because I think it's so easy when you're writing a book to just overdo it. Like, you add way too much. And having that forcing function of like, hey, it's just 9 components at maximum, it actually forced me to like kill a lot of things and not take them out and really focus on like, what is the, back to the like 80-20 principle, what are the things that, you know, isn't like fully comprehensive in the sense that like there's more than 9 things you got to do to make PLG work, but these are like the 80-20 things that if you focus on them, you'll get the most bang for your buck. Absolutely.
Right, right. Oh, that's a great input. And yeah, I think there's something to do with the 3-1-3-9 kind of thing. There are many, many references of that, pretty much like the Pareto principle, right? The 20-80, 80-20, 20-80, whatever you call it, that bit. I mean, it pretty much works out most of the time, which is amazing. I mean, you wonder how it really does work that way. So let's go into the foundation, and while we go into it, I want you to touch upon one thing. How much of PLG is positioning, actually? How much of your PLG motion comes from clarity of positioning of the product? Touch upon that, and then we can go into the foundation piece, which is your section one.
Yeah, for sure. So as far as like positioning, I think it's less about positioning and more about integration. So when I mean integration, what I'm talking about is like, how do we think about using the product inside this company? How do we utilize it? And is it like a part of our DNA? So in a sales-led company, as an example, you would have like your sales marketing motion over here on the left side. And then you have like, once you sell, then you have the product side and delivery on the other. And so it's very kind of like one side to the other. A lot of times in that kind of environment, the sales team might sell something and then it's like, okay, product team, make that. And so it's a lot less like products leading the business. Whereas in a product-led business, it's literally baked into your business, like the acquisition side of things, getting those free trial, those signups, that's your offer on your page. And then the engagement, the product does all that stuff to get people to value. And then monetization as well. That's also largely done by the product. Not always and in every case, but products are doing that. So it's just, we integrate the product into every piece of the business.
So let me pick up the first one, which is very provocative. The first component, the strategy component. And the first thing you start off with is, which market can you dominate? Now, the reason I want to touch upon it is very interesting, because some of the conversations I'm having is that a lot of SaaS is not original in the sense that they're like copies of something which already is there out there in the market, maybe with some twist, maybe with some, you know, some additional stuff, whatever you call it, features or whatever. How does this actually fit? I mean, say it's a very PLG friendly product, which can obviously go for a PLG motion. But when you want to think of dominating, is it about niching down? Is that the way you dominate? Or is there something else that you are thinking about here?
Yes. And so this is my sneaky way of getting people to think, hey, what could I win at? Because I think a lot of founders catch themselves in this position where it's like they're up in a big market or something like that. They feel defeated in some ways where they're like, oh, my competitors have like way more funding. And I'm like, screw that. Like, you can win in a market if we narrow it down enough. Every founder can win. At the end of the day, it's not a zero-sum game. And like, even if you look at like the big project management apps or stuff like that too, like I just found out about another one and I was like, man, this is like really specific to like client services consultants. Like, maybe we switch because it's literally built for us and it's much better at some other things we need. And so that's the whole premise behind finding a market that you can dominate, is you really have to get specific. And what I'm trying to build here is the confidence that comes with that. When you're like, this is it, we can really do this. And this is a market we can own and we really can defend against too, because we, in the other parts of the strategy, can build moats that will actually protect us and make it defensible. And so, yes, that's why I wanted to kind of focus in on that for the first part.
I think it is sort of like a mystery to me why so few SaaS companies still do not have clarity about their ICP.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like linked, right? At a level.
Yep.
I mean, you're, so, I mean, it's weird. I mean, I was in this meet where I met like a couple of hundred founders in San Francisco, and they were in commodity products, a lot of them, right? I mean, they were doing similar stuff, which is, I mean, very few are really, really unique that doesn't exist and they're trying to do something. I mean, there are, but not many. But most of them, they're still talking of the big picture, right?
Totally.
We have this 5 different kinds of guys who can use us. And if you go to the website, there'll be 5 different use cases, right? And it's not that they're doing $100 million. If you're doing $100 million or more, I can understand that you need to expand because then you're getting stuck, you're stagnating and so on and so forth. But you're like a million, 2 million, 5 million. Then it's a mystery to me. I mean, it is obvious, right? And this is not what you are telling me or I'm telling you. Steve Blank wrote this like what? 30
wow,
years back. And we don't do it. I mean, the mystery is why we don't do it, I think. But I think we'll keep that discussion for another day. Unless you want to join in.
I mean, I think there's so many reasons why people don't do it. That there's, whether it's like, they think, oh yeah, like I'm going to be saying no to other people. And it's like, yes, that's kind of how it works. Or it's saying no to like, oh, that could work and we could help them. And so I think it really, I think Jim Collins said it really well in his book. If you go to like his website, he's got like disciplined thought, disciplined execution and like disciplined action, all that stuff. And I think it really comes down to there's a lack of discipline in how you build your business. And that lack of discipline is causing you to be unfocused. And the whole point of a strategy is to have a disciplined line of sight of like, hey, this is the decision-making framework. And we're going to make decisions based on this strategy. And in order to follow through, we're going to focus on just these things. And it's actually harder to say no to some of these things than it is to just say yes to everything. It's just one will get you in a much better position over the long term versus the short term kind of loss of, oh, we had to say no to that customer. That sucks. But you're also saying like no to all these other potential people that could find you and be like, this is it because you're speaking to me.
Yeah, yeah. And that sort of takes us to your second component, which is the user component, right? Knowing your ideal customer.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break,
you haven't mapped out the user journey. You don't know, like, where are they getting stuck? What are the biggest challenges, not just in the product, but from the very first point where they realize I have a problem to the point where they're like, oh, here's my credit card upgrade. Like, there's a ton of steps within there. And what we tried to do in the book is just break it down into 5 main stages. And each of those stages has kind of 2 main steps.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end. Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it.
What from your experience of this 300 to 500 customers that you worked with over the last 5 years, where do you think people actually go wrong? And why do they have so much difficulty, if I may say so, in actually figuring out the ideal user?
Yeah, I think they, when it comes to understanding your user better than anyone else in your market, I think they go wrong in usually three different areas. So the first one you touched on, which is you just don't pinpoint, you don't understand who that is. The second one is really like you're not clear on what is success for this user. You will ask everybody in the company, you'll get like a bunch of different responses. Then the third thing is usually you haven't mapped out the user journey. You don't know like, where are they getting stuck? What are the biggest challenges, not just in the product, but from the very first point where they realize I have a problem to the point where they're like, oh, here's my credit card upgrade. Like there's a ton of steps within there. And what we tried to do in the book is just break it down into five main stages. And each of those stages has kind of two main steps. And when we broke it down that way, and then it was just a matter of let's define each of these steps. And then let's break down, like, what are those challenges for each of those steps? And when we did that, what we found is that people just had a lot of clarity, like, oh, they're getting stuck on the first strike step. Nobody's getting to value first. Why is that? Let's look at the challenges. And, oh, we have some unidentified challenges here. Let's interview the people that got stuck. Great idea. And then it just opens up a dialogue for, okay, we can understand them better than anyone else in the market. If we can do that and provide them with the right solutions and the model and the product and onboarding, all that stuff, then we can serve them the best. And so I always just think it's a mixture of those three. It's not just one thing, but it all starts with identifying like who is that ideal user first.
Yeah. And would you say that in some cases it might get difficult to actually pinpoint the ideal customer inside a use case of your product? For instance, if you're in logistics, it's very difficult to actually, because there may be multiple stakeholders involved who will actually benefit at multiple levels of the usage of the product. Do you see that as a challenge?
Oh, yeah. And I think like one of the biggest things like I always walk through in the book too is like there's motivation. So like how motivated is your ideal user? There's the ability, like can they see value in your product? But then also triggers, like are they getting reminded of all these things, like to use this to solve this problem? But the one thing that really leans into what you were saying is, does your product shine the best for this specific kind of user? So an example in the book I share is Senja.io. They're like a testimonial SaaS application to make it easy to collect testimonials and showcase them on your site. And so whenever like they were looking at who is our ideal user, there was like SaaS founders was one group, but the other one was like course creators. So all the SaaS founders, we had them on our like coaching call and they're like, sounds great, but you don't integrate with G2, you don't integrate with Trustpilot, all these other sites that we're already using. I'm not that interested in it. I don't need another tool in my stack. And you would have to do all these other things to make it make sense. Now, you talk to course creators and they're like, wow, you do all that? Fantastic. Like, where can I pay? And they immediately saw like this was a part of their marketing toolkit to help them sell, whether it's more courses or other stuff too. And it had everything it needed. And so that ideal user for them was just like rocket fuel. Once they started to focus in on it, then it was great. But the part I don't mention in the book is like, it still took Ollie, the founder, about 4 to 6 months to decide to double down on that specific ideal user, because there is sometimes that feedback loop. You got to hear it enough times as a founder to be like, I got it. Like it's this like sign from heaven. You must listen and focus on course creators. Sometimes it takes a while for founders, including myself.
And this is great because a lot of times these market slices are not so visible, right? SaaS founders are visible. Mm-hmm. Course creators are not necessarily visible. You know what I mean? So I think the challenge of saying, okay, oh, I thought here I'm building a $50 million business. And suddenly when I say course creators, I'm talking of a $5 million business, but this $5 million business will actually happen. And that 50 million is not going to happen. I mean, in a sort of rationalizing and making peace with that, I guess is also part of the 46 months is a long time. And by the way, I would think that is a example you will find in dozens where people have taken years to figure out.
Totally.
I think I'm not going to replace Salesforce after all. Let me do this, you know?
Yeah. And there's one or two kind of like underrated things like with when it comes to your strategy and then the user side of things too, which is just there's commitment of following through and then there's conviction. Whenever things get really tough, you're like, I don't know about this. It's like, do you have conviction this is the right user or not? Like I can tell you with conviction, like B2B SaaS founders for us, it's the best kind of focus for us. It's our ideal users. That's where we want to serve. We know that because we've done all that research and I know that is where we're going to have the biggest impact. So it should come with that confidence that we're going to double down here and ignore some other potentially great lucrative opportunities on like the senior product exec sides and everything else like that too, to double down here. And so, yeah, just wanted to share that because I think that's the reading between the lines is important.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. How critical is self-serve? Because a lot of times, unless you're like some of the examples you mentioned earlier when we started the conversation about very straightforward products, which is like, okay, this is a note taker. That's it. That's what it does, yeah. or whatever. How easy it is for companies to actually build the self-serve motion, because it obviously has the first part, which is they must be motivated prospects who really have that pain. So
yes.
For them to be motivated enough to come and do it, but to componentize it so that they get to that wow moment, they get the value first. How easy or difficult is that process?
I think it's one of the hardest pieces for product companies to get going. Like in the beginning of the book, I mentioned, I was like, right now it's actually kind of sad. Like the sales like companies in the early stages, they're winning out because it's a much easier go-to-market motion. It's like, hey, here's the call. We'll go through how to set this up. And as long as you build trust, you can showcase the value, or at least what the potential value would be since you don't actually see it for yourself most times, then you can make the sale. Whereas in a product that company, if it's self-serve, there's not as many at-bats. Like you don't necessarily have the people to like, hey, let me walk through what your exact use case is. It's like, and that goes back to why you have to be really specific on your ideal user, because if you're trying to be everything to everybody, they're not going to see the value in the product the same, and they're going to have to figure it out on their own, which when that happens, it's usually not the best because they don't figure it out at the end of the day. And so, yeah, I would just kind of focus on understanding that ideal user and then focusing that journey around them.
Right, right. There is one of the, recommendations on the book is from the User Flow guys. So they have written a glowing, and they have a great, interesting tidbit there saying that they went from zero to, I think, 5 million with three people. Would you, I mean, that looks very attractive for anybody trying to build a SaaS. Like, oh my God, if they could do it, we could do it. So what were the things that were working in their favor? I don't know whether you talk about them in the book at all or not, but I'm just curious if you have something to share in terms of what, you know, there are a couple of other people like Adam Robinson trying to do this with RB2B. And I mean, there's a lot of talk about this. I mean, having a very small, tight team and using technology and using PLG motions to build a large company, right? So ambitions are like all over the place, right? So what actually makes those kind of stories actually happen? I'm sure it's not like hundreds of these are there. I'm sure these are, isolated pieces, but what makes that happen?
Well, I think it's going to become more common with product-led companies with, like in the second phase of the book, it's all about like, how do you unlock self-serve customers? But the main goal of that is really about leverage. So how do you scale? How do you get to like 1 million plus like revenue per employee? You can't do that usually at least with the typical sales-led model, because if you go through, like, how does it work and break it down, usually when they're at scale and trying to grow, it's like, okay, we got to hire more salespeople. We got to keep that going. They have X bump in quota for every single rep. And so we just have to grow that way. Whereas a product-led company, like, and back to like Esben and the user flow team, what they did really, really well is they had, like, Esben was working on the growth side, doing like all the ads and everything else for the marketing side. Then they had the other person, other founder was focused more on the developments and kind of the CEO side of the job. And then they had one person just doing the customer support side and making sure customers were successful and whatnot. And so that can scale really, really well at the end of the day, because the one employee that I don't mention here is the product. The product was the main thing that people were signing up for. It was onboarding people, eating their own dog food. User flow was onboarding people. And it was also monetizing them at the end of the day too. And so there was a lot of conversations that could have been had if it was like, hey, how do I get to value and whatnot? It's like, wow, we got to hire more reps to handle all these customers on that end. But the product did a great job to make it easy to go through that. And that created the leverage that they needed to get to that scale without adding a lot more headcount.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just remembering about Spark Toro and Rand Fishkin. They're literally doing very similar stuff, right? And the interesting thing about Spark Toro there, which you must have noticed, is that they're not even trying to sell you a annual subscription. They're saying, come and use it for 2 months when you need it most, and then don't. Then come back again when you need it later. And yet they're hitting very, very enviable revenue numbers at this point in time. Talking about I'm moving into the last portion where you're talking about expansion and how you actually sort of now scale this motion. Analytics is a big component of that, right? Understanding what's going on with the user and the product. Would you like to elaborate a bit on this and where people, again, you see people are not doing what they ought to be doing, not investing enough time or money or whatever energy to really figure that out? What have you understood from your work with this customers in the last 5 years?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things is just keeping it simple. I think the biggest outcome of that component for the data side is just creating a new scorecard for your company to use every single week in a weekly meeting where you review it and you go through what that looks like. Now, I would note, because I've done this the wrong way many times, or I remember our first scorecard at Product-Led, I was like, 36 metrics included. And we were a team of 5 at that time. But I was like, I thought that was a good idea, but there was like 8 metrics for each person, basically. And I was like, this is not sustainable. And focus was diffused in so many different ways. And so the basic thing we broke down is there's like your North Star metric. You got to understand what that looks like. That's one metric. Then there's about 6 or 7 go-to-market metrics that break down the entire flow for how people go through your website and get to value. So there's like number of users, there's signups, there's number of people who go through onboarding successfully, number of people get through a first strike, key usage indicator that you get value multiple times, they upgrade. Then you can just look at like churn and expansion. And so that's like really quick, but that's your entire go-to-market metrics. And we also have like business health metrics that just look at things like maybe your monthly recurring revenue, your cash balance. Just pick like 2 to 4 core metrics that just help you understand as a leadership team, like, is the business okay or not? And how we can go from there. And so reviewing that every single week, the main outcome is just, where is the bottleneck in the business? You should know that at all times. And what's great is if you set up the right accountability, whoever that person is who's stuck on that number, they basically become the CEO of the business. They can enroll support from everybody else and say, hey, like, we're low on signups. I know it's impacting your numbers and everybody else's, but I need your help. We got to do these specific things. And they're in charge of like that plan of attack to turn this around, to actually own the metric. And so, yeah, we found that works super well at the end of the day.
Right, right. And how do you, in the early stage, of course, we are in the expansion part, but I think this is equally important in the early days as well. in the sense that you need to sort of tweak for the right matrix, right? So when you don't have enough data, what are you looking out for?
Yeah, if you don't have the right data, then you're really kind of flying blind in some ways. So what's often really common for a lot of early stage product-led companies, I would say, is you have certain gaps in your go-to-market motion. So you might have like from sign up to upgrade, and you have no intel on like number of people going through onboarding, getting value in the products. And so then you have to subset that with, okay, let's watch like user recordings. Let's talk to specific users. Where did they get stuck? And so you got to do a bit more validation and digging, right, which is honestly, it's not the end of the world. Like I think everybody should have like a screen recording tool or something like that installed to do that and just understand like where are people getting stuck and yeah, and go from that part.
Fair enough. Let me jump to the end where you're talking about becoming the obvious choice in the market. And that sort of linked back to the first piece that we had discussed earlier. How do you actually do that as a deliberate motion? How are you deliberate about it, that I should be the obvious choice in the market that I'm choosing?
Yep. So the main thinking behind it is like in the very beginning of the book, we talk about like, what do your customers want? So like 97% of B2B buyers want to try before they buy versus talk to someone in sales. So it's like, okay, we know we got to have a good product-led motion, but then only 7% of product-led motions, people actually say it's great. So the main thinking behind that is like, if we want to really give people the go-to-market motion they want and have the best one, we got to do these 9 core things really, really well, which we outline in the product-led system. And so every single stage helps you kind of break out in the market. And so there's like this triangle or pyramid that breaks down the market into 4 kind of main places you will land as a company. There's like the bottom rung, which is your commodity. It's hard to grow. You don't want to be there. It's scary. And then there's like the next level up is you're a contender. You actually do something different. You stand for something. And if you do, you know, the stage one of the book, the product that system, like your strategy, your user, your model, you can actually become a contender. But then the next level up is, are you on the cusp of your market, like the top 3 to 5 folks? And what a lot of people think there is that you need to have like this big team, you need to increase like the amount you spend on your team and everything else like that. Although you do need good people at that stage, you need to start building a leadership team. What you really need is leverage. You need that leverage so you can reinvest in R&D because you're cutthroat with all these other competitors that are copying you. And so you need to gain leverage. And so how you do that is stage 2, which is unlocking self-serve customers with the right offer and onboarding and pricing. And then the last piece to really lock it in and tie everything up for how to become the obvious choice is it's not about just building the best product. That's what a lot of people think. It's a myth. But actually, to become the obvious choice in the market, you need to own the market. You need to dominate the market. You need to become the number one choice. And how you do that is you need to be the number one option they see, whether it's in search, ads, that they think about. You own the mind share. How you do that, though, is you need to always understand your biggest bottleneck, run the growth experiments to really tackle and gain the majority of the market share. And then you got to hire and deploy the best team possible to do that. And so overall, everything in the book is just catered towards how do we get you to become the obvious choice in your market.
By reading the book, how close can someone come to actually implementing it? Or would they need more help? Is this for them to open their mind to what they need to do versus actually going out and doing it? How would you place it? How close this is this to a workbook vis-a-vis your understanding of the space so that you can do the right things and know what to look out for?
Yeah. So it was always designed as a workbook. So hence the name Playbook. I was like, it's meant to be really a way where you can implement it yourself and go through it. Now, our whole business model is, and this is like us trying to eat our own dog food with this book, is our mission is like all our books, we want to be able to give them away for free. Now, this upcoming book, the thinking behind it is we want to be able to like fully support that, even like hardcover, paperback, all the formats one day to give them for free, because we find that a lot of people will be able to implement it, to DIY it themselves. But then there's other people that are like, great, this is the approach we need. We're sold on it, but we just want help implementing it. And that's exactly what our business does. And that's actually puts us in a position where it's we're uncopyable in that sense, where it's like, oh yeah, you want to implement that system? We're the only people that do that. And we would love to work with you on that end.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Wes, anything else that you'd like to talk about that I have not sort of still asked or gone into?
I think we honestly covered so many good things. This has been fun going through this chat.
Wes, thank you again for coming on the podcast and sharing. It is always very, very insightful talking to you. And I hope your next book is not 5 years away.
No, it's not. I already started. It's at the very end. Okay. I got a little bit like preview of the next book.
Wonderful. I would hope to get you back sooner on this one. And all the best for your SaaS Talk outing.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.